Our next case is Bombardier Recreational Products versus Arctic Cat, 2018-2488 and 2424.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Kevin Keneally for BRP. The district court committed several errors in denying BRP's JMOL motion after trial on the issues relating to Arctic Cat's invalidity defenses. I'd like to start by highlighting one relating to Claim 8 in the 847 patent. Claim 8 is a dependent patent claim, and the court, unfortunately, at A22 and 23 in its post-trial rulings, simply glossed over it. It made no mention of it at all. And that's probably indicative of the failure of proof that Arctic Cat made at trial through its expert. If you look in the blue brief on pages 35 and 36, and here I need to point out an error of our own. I apologize to the panel. We have a reference at the top of page 36 to A3538. And that page is actually found in the appendix at 3471. But on the bottom of 35, carrying over to the top of 36, what you will plainly see is six lines of conclusory hindsight testimony from Mr. Karpik, Arctic Cat's expert, about claims 7 and 8. Not looking at the claim language, not talking about motivation to combine. This is the kind of hindsight and conclusory testimony this court has repeatedly said was insufficient as a matter of law in cases like InTouch and other cases that we cite in our briefs. I just wanted to point that out on the 847 patent with respect to that failure as indicative of the other obviousness failures that the district court made, probably because of the lack of proof by Arctic Cat. There's simply nothing addressing any of the KSR factors with respect to claims 7 and 8, the upper column limitation and the upper column forming the apex, including secondary considerations.
We're going to be considering substantial evidence. That's the standard we should look at. And we have to presume that the jury made fact findings in favor of finding these claims invalid, right? Your argument really is failure of proof. Does it matter necessarily whether in the JMOL motion or the JMOL decision the district court talked about, I guess I'm wondering, what is the import of errors in the district court's decision? So long as if we find substantial evidence to support the jury's factual findings, isn't that sufficient? Don't we review judgments, not opinions, when we're looking at JMOL, right?
You do, Your Honor. But part of your premise is that there was substantial evidence in the record, and that's right. What I was trying to point out with my comments.
I get it. I want to make sure you're focusing on that. That's
right.
All.
No, that's okay. Right. So where there is simply conclusory expert testimony that doesn't address any of the KSR factors, including motivation, that is the basis on which we think the evidence was insufficient. And that's why the JMOL should have been granted on obviousness as to those elements, those claims of the 847 patent. I would like to turn, in the interest of time, to the 669 patent, where there are also errors that the district court committed with respect to indefiniteness. And if there's time, we'll talk about anticipation as well. The 669 patent is not indefinite as a matter of law. The sole claim term that was at issue was this term seat position defined by a seat.
Is that construction of that term, seat position defined by the seat, the construction there that reads in figures 9A, 9B, and 10, that was your proposed construction, is that correct?
We did, yes. Actually, I should be clear. We proposed that it be the definition, the specification of the standard writer, and then the court said, in fairness, we should the standard writer according to claim to figures 9A, 9B, and 10.
Okay.
But we didn't oppose reading that in.
And you haven't appealed that
No one's appealing the claim construction.
The claim construction at all.
No one's appealing the claim construction.
What do we do where there's expert testimony disputing whether one of ordinary skill in the art can look at figures 9A, 9B, and 10 and figure out what this is defining?
You take this court's guidance from the Biosig case after a remand from the Supreme Court, and you look at the intrinsic record and you say, was there enough guidance in the intrinsic record for someone of skill in the art to look at figure 9A and determine what are the relevant dimensions in order to practice the patent?
Isn't there a jury finding on that factual issue?
On the question of
whether looking at figures 9A, 9B, and 10, there was conflicting expert testimony on how a POSA would look at that, how a person of ordinary skill in the art would understand that. And there's a jury finding of indefiniteness.
I would say this, Your Honor. We fought against, at the jury charge, we fought against having this jury instruction because we considered it to be an issue of law. And if there were underlying factual issues, the court could make those factual findings.
Are there underlying factual issues here?
No. Because there are no errors that are relevant to the dimensions of finding the 50th percentile adult male.
That's what I find interesting about your argument, is that you accept, because you advanced the notion that your claim construction for this seat position limitation rests on lexicography. Your side, the inventor, was his own lexicographer in defining this particular claim term. And nobody is disputing that on appeal. So the district court had to identify what was the definition provided in the specification. And it found, reasonably, I think, the idea that it's whatever a standard rider would be, and then all the elements that are described as being the ruler for what a standard rider is in the written description, including all the dimensions itemized in figures 9A, 9B, and 10. Your argument in your briefing and today seems to be, well, only some of those dimensions that are listed in figures 9A, 9B, and 10 really matter, and we should ignore the other dimensions that turn out to have lots of mathematical defects in them as not being relevant. And I just don't understand how you can try to define your lexicography by only half a loaf. I think you have to take the whole loaf. And if it turns out there's lots of mold in your loaf, that's really the problem and defect that you have to live with the lexicographic definition provided in your written description.
Taking no offense at the mold reference, Your Honor, let me try to unpack that, because you have to look at the one of ordinary skill on a definiteness analysis has to look at the intrinsic record, and this court has to look at the intrinsic record and say, could someone of ordinary skill understand the claim scope with reasonable certainty? So let me try to address that very point. At trial, my friends brought out a number of errors in the 90th percentile and the 10th percentile. Now, everyone agrees those can't be relevant because the only thing claimed is a 50th percentile. They also tried to convince the jury that the standing height of an adult male was somehow relevant to determining the dimensions of the standard rider on a snowmobile. It may be relevant for your driver's license, but it certainly isn't relevant in the context of this patent. So let's talk about the intrinsic record. When you look at figure 7 of the patent, you see a rider, a one-up rider, single person on the road, and that shows very common sense, someone seated on a straddle seat with their arms forward and their feet NH-well. But I think the best proof of what the intrinsic record shows are the relevant dimensions are the portion that Arcticat actually cites in its own brief, and I'm on page 7 of their brief. It can also be found in the appendix at 6563, where the inventors told the patent office very clearly during prosecution what the relevant dimensions were. They said, contrasting their invention with a prior art, they said, well, don't look at that prior art. Here are the relevant dimensions.
The standard. I'm looking at page 7 in the red brief. Maybe you're about to read it, but what part are you relying on?
At the very bottom, Your Honor.
Okay.
There's a site to APPX 6563.
The standard rider has a torso length of 45.7 centimeters. I see.
Yes.
And the problem I'm having is simply the claim construction that of this term that was provided to the court, and it's not on appeal. And that's the construction of the term. And it's not that the standard rider has a torso length of 45.7 centimeters. It's instead something that refers to figures 9A, 9B, and 10, and which were the subject of expert testimony that the jury could have credited, saying that there were errors and that one of ordinary skill in the art would have difficulty understanding how to follow those figures to figure out what the 50th percentile person is. But I understand that the term seat position defined by the seat seems like something probably every snowmobile could have.
And it
does.
But
the problem is the claim construction.
Well, respectfully, it's Arcticat who's trying to imbue ambiguity where there is none. I was pointing the court to those five or six dimensions that are the intrinsic record tells the person of ordinary skill and tells the court these are the relevant dimensions. So our expert, Dr. Rausch, took those dimensions, looking at figure 7 of that rider, and said, that rider, I'm going to use those dimensions. I'm not going to use standing height or some outstretched arm. And that's what she did. And that's what she proved infringement with. That's what we proved infringement with before the jury. That's how we proved the patent was not enabled. That's how Arcticat's own expert used the standard ATD, the dummy, which with these same dimensions, in order to try to prove invalidity. Everyone used the same method.
Is there a standard dummy that's the 50th percentile North American man?
There is.
Mm-hmm. I thought there were some difficulties in making a proper dummy in this case.
I think the questioning at that point, Your Honor, was whether it would be difficult with all the errors that don't relate to the seat standard position. It might be hard if you incorporated the standard dummy with the standing height error. I think that was the testimony. But no one, it was undisputed. Dr. Rausch, our expert at trial, was able to use the figures I just recited that are in the prosecution history, the torso, the two arm lengths, the leg lengths, and compare that to the dummy, and she did, and it's very close. And that's how she determined the seat position. And I'd also like to remember, this is an issue of law for the court on indefiniteness.
Well, I think there could be underlying issues of fact, just like in claim construction. We have been instructed that there could be underlying issues of fact. Similarly, in indefiniteness, there could be underlying issues of fact as you're trying to determine what the scope of a claim is and whether it's even could be determined. Right?
That's true. But when a party tries to interject ambiguity where there is none, that's not relevant to...
Did they have an expert who's... Okay, your point is that the expert testimony is irrelevant.
Yes. Their expert attacks on the standard position, or excuse me, on the seat position defined by the seat are irrelevant. And I'll raise another issue. Claim 88 is different in kind from some of the other claims that were in the case that are in the patent in the 669. And if I could just refer the court in the appendix at 401, this is column 21. Claim 80, another independent claim, requires that invention have a seat position disposed a certain distance from another component of the snowmobile, the forwardmost drivetrack axle. Claim 97 is another claim of the patent, not asserted here, where the seat position is disposed some distance relative to something else. For those kinds of claims, I could understand if a party was going to try to make some definiteness standards argument, but the seat position defined by the seat in Claim 88 is just that. It doesn't require some sort of further scrutiny. The construction that was given to the jury was for its aid to understand what it meant. But the claim, 88, it calls out a straddle-type seat, a standard component of the conventional snowmobile, a standard component of our claimed snowmobiles, a standard component of the infringing snowmobiles.
Counsel, you're well into your rebuttal time. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal, but before you sit down into your seat position, there's been a motion by Appellee to supplement the record with 3 pages of testimony. I assume you don't object.
Well, as the party who first noticed that it was missing, I have no objection, Your Honor.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. McLeod.
Good morning, Your Honors. Neil McLeod representing Appellee Articat. May it please the court. From counsel's comments, it sounds like they're slowly coming to realize that it is the claims as construed that matter for purposes of indefiniteness. You don't construe claims and then push the construction aside and go back to analyzing the unconstrued claim. It's the construction that matters. It's what the claims mean that that you look at for indefiniteness. Anything else would be illogical and I think inconsistent because, as the court pointed out, the construction of seat position defined by the seat is actually what they proposed and the court adopted.
How do you respond to the point that your client's expert testimony is irrelevant because it talks about measurements that have about the 90th percentile male, or the 10th percentile male, or positions that, you know, total height, not something that matters with respect to sitting on the snowmobile?
In a couple ways, Your Honor. First, he did analyze the 50th percentile dimensions, which are the middle dimensions on those figures. He expressly said in his testimony, I'll ignore the 5th and 95th percentile errors, although there are some. With respect to what dimensions are relevant, first of all, there is no carve-out in the construction for the following dimensions in figures 9A and B. There was no proposal like that from BRP that only these dimensions matter. But more to the point, our expert, Warner, did analyze those dimensions. The point that Mr. Warner was making with respect to the overall height of the bodybuilding figures 9 and 10 and the overall arm dimension is that they don't add up. The overall dimension does not match all these sub-dimensions. You don't know where the errors are. You can't account for that discrepancy. It makes it more than just an error. It makes that ruler, and this is the claimed ruler, let there be no mistake about that. The only reason we're talking about these figures is because that is the ruler that all measurements are made with. You don't know what the dimensions of that ruler are because of the discrepancy between the overall dimension and all the subdimensions that BRP says are relevant. An analogy I thought of is, I think it's a good one. If somebody hands you a ruler and it's got 14 on the left side, 14 units, whatever, inches, centimeters, and on the right side it's got 23, for example, inches or centimeters, whatever dimensions, and they say, you know, go measure something. Go measure the court's a bench and report back with reasonable certainty as to what the height is. You can't do it with that ruler, and that's the ruler I'm describing. You can't do it. You can flip a coin, which is what I think their expert did, and said, well, I'm going to choose these dimensions and ignore the fact that they're inconsistent with the overall height dimension. But if you're being honest, you have to report back, I cannot do this measurement with the tool I've been given. It's broken. It doesn't work. You can't do it. You can't come to any reasonable certainty on what the height of that bench is with this flawed ruler. So that was the point of his testimony. And he did address the relevant dimension, what BRP calls the relevant dimensions, in terms of the overall height. And his testimony really shows that you can't do anything with this ruler because you have no idea where the discrepancies lie. There was also...
In analyzing the validity of the claims in view of the prior art, you had an expert who was able to present evidence, right, based on, I think, just standard measurements of a North American male of 50th percentile, right? Maybe there was a dummy that had those dimensions. Why is it that we shouldn't ignore the errors in the figures in this case, since one of ordinary skill in the art would know that there's a standard dummy that has those dimensions?
First of all, the dummy that they used does not have the same dimensions as the one as the dimensions of the patent. It couldn't. Those dimensions are flawed. You can't determine what they are. So the dummy is, I think our testimony was from Warner, it's not a surrogate, and we've shown that in our briefs. It's not a surrogate for what is claimed in the patent. The dummy photos you saw were, by our expert, were an attempt to replicate measurements that BRP was doing for infringement. And he was only using the dummy, so he couldn't be accused later of doing his own measurements. He was trying to replicate what they were doing for purposes of infringement. But our position is you can't do any measurements with this body build in figures 9A and 9B and 10 at all. You can't come to any conclusions. And the ATD doesn't help you. ATD mean the dummy that was used. Counsel brought up claim 80, which was previously asserted in the case. And that's actually when the parties, experts, were using the crash test dummy to do measurements. Claim 80 is actually instructive here. Claim 80 also recites the term seat position defined by the seat. Claim 80 does provide an actual measurement using that seat position defined by the seat, which is a point on the seat. There should be no mistake about that. It is a point. Claim 80 says the seat position defined by the seat must be less than 590 millimeters from the forward axle. So it's a precise measurement. 591 would escape infringement. 589 millimeters would be within that limitation. The point I'm trying to make is seat position is in both of those claims. It means the same thing in both those claims. It's a rare case where a claim term means something different in one claim than it does in another. Claim 80, I think, emphasizes, or you get a greater sense or a quicker sense of just how indefinite these claims are because of seat position defined by the seat. You can't take any measurements down to the 590 millimeter dimension using this flawed ruler, where you don't even know which dimensions to use. I'd like to address a few things on the 847 patent. I think the court pointed out we really are just, BRP's appeal really is just about contesting the evidence, saying there's not enough substantial evidence. And we're up here on appeal with a jury verdict that there was. You have to view the facts in light most favorable to Articat, and they did find claims 1, 6, and 8, 6, 7, and 8 of the 847 patent invalid.
Do you agree with opposing counsel's assessment of the only evidence that was provided on claim 8 and showing its invalidity?
No, I don't. The evidence is that the upper column that was referred to in claim 8 is prior art. It's admitted prior art in their patent. That's evidence. Our expert did testify as to a motivation to combine this simple prior art structure, the upper column, with snowmobiles, and that's at appendix 3475. So there is a motivation to combine in the record. They seem to be hung up on, or seem to be suggesting there's some requirement that an expert sit and recite every single claim every time he's going through it, almost like a magic words requirement that experts have to go through, and there isn't one, and the reason probably for that is clear. That would be a rather onerous thing for experts to do, is to memorize each claim and recite it every time you move on to the next claim. I will point out that when our expert Karpik was testifying regarding these claims, he was using, as experts often do in patent cases, a claim chart up on the screen, where he was checking off each box for each claim as he went through it. So the claim term for claim 8 and for claim 7 and for claim 6 were all on the screen for the jury when he was marching through his analysis.
Now you've withdrawn your cross appeal.
We have.
Are you still arguing non-infringement?
We are. I don't think that dropping the cross-appeal affects that.
Right.
Why not? Why not under Radio Steel, where the judgment in this case, if you look at the district court's judgment, it has one paragraph related to infringement and a different paragraph related to validity. So why wouldn't your argument, if you were successful, enlarge the scope of the judgment, thus requiring you to file a cross-appeal?
I don't know that specific case. I'm sorry, I don't. But all the other cases I've read on this in the court's precedent are that infringement is, I guess you could call it a subset of invalidity. You can't infringe an invalid claim. So with the defense of non-infringement, you are not enlarging your finding of invalidity.
In other words, you were a winner on invalidity.
Essentially, yeah, the prevailing part on invalidity. Just a few comments on the anticipation of Claim 88 of the 669 patent under Hittin and Foxtrack. I think in BRP's brief, they're confusing a few things on the Hittin. First of all, they concede that the Hittin snowmobile anticipates Claim 88 of the 669 patent. They don't dispute any of the elements are there. They don't even dispute it's public. They just say it wasn't public enough. It was public. It was rode by Roger Skime on a public highway in Minnesota. It's fully corroborated. What BRP, I think, misses in their brief is that the Hittin snowmobile itself, which we had at trial, and the jury saw it, and all the witnesses identified it. The Hittin snowmobile itself is corroborating. You can corroborate with a physical exhibit as much as you can with a document. So the Hittin snowmobile corroborates Roger Skime's.
I guess your public use argument makes me wonder if we start to adopt it, we start going down a slippery slope. We have witness A saying, oh, yeah, I remember seeing this snowmobile 35 years ago. I rode on it. And then you have witness B saying, oh, yeah, I remember seeing that snowmobile 20 years ago. And then that's it. Like, if that was the evidence of so-called corroboration, would that be enough?
I would
two
think
witnesses saying they saw it 20 years ago?
Somewhere in there, it's not enough. I would say that it is in this case, obviously. You have two witnesses identifying the exact same snowmobile. It's a distinctive snowmobile. They're not saying, you know, I saw a Toyota out in the seat that you may have seen 10 years ago. It's a distinctive snowmobile, and we have more than two. We have also Joel Hallstrom, who said he saw a photograph of that very distinctive snowmobile in 1987. And we have the later testimony of witnesses who heard about Roger Skime's ride on the Hittin snowmobile. And again, he pointed out the exact snowmobile, and it's a distinctive one that he rode on.
You think it's a matter of the credibility of the witnesses?
I'm sure that is sure that's part of it, probably a major part of it. And you know, that's something for the jury to really examine credibility and things like that. I only have a minute and a half left. I just wanted a few more words about the obviousness of the dependent claims in the 669 patent. That's claims 92 to 95. Those add what I would call minor limitations to a claim that's already been found to be anticipated. They add those ranges for the steering position. We're asking the court to reverse the district court on this, where he found those are not obvious. So why are we special? Why can we get up here and say reversal's a good idea for that, whereas BRP can't for any of theirs? I think the court below on this issue spent or gave an inordinate amount of weight to the fact that when you combine two references, you often have to make modifications. He seemed to be hung up on that. That if you combine the Hittin, for example, or the Foxtrack, for example, with...
Can I interrupt you just for a minute?
Sure.
This issue that you're talking about, there's a jury verdict on this issue, right?
Or
am I confusing the issues?
There's no finding that claims 92 to 95 are obvious.
So the question is whether substantial evidence supports the jury's verdict, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm saying there isn't to support that.
So you're going to explain why there's no evidence?
I'm going to explain why there isn't substantial evidence. The court gave an inordinate amount of...
The jury gave an inordinate amount.
The jury, too. To the fact that you have to modify the prior art sometimes. If that was the standard, you could never combine two references because there's always going to be modifications when you combine two things. The key part of this, though, is that BRP's own expert witness, when asked about these claims and the claim ranges, he was asked whether a person of skill of art in the 1990s, i.e. back in the prior art days, without knowledge of the 669 patent, the question expressly excluded the 669 patent, would be motivated to use the 40 to 90 millimeter ranges. And his answer was, if that range complemented his or her design, yes. So their own expert is saying these ranges are nothing but a design choice, well within the skill of one in the art.
Thank you, counsel.
That testimony is...
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Keneally has 2 minutes for rebuttal if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. With the point that, with regard to the claim construction point the counsel was making, the court construed the claim seat position defined by the seat as referring to the body build of that 50th percentile male and seated in a natural operating position, not standing, not walking, not stretching its arms out, seated in a natural operating position. And we submit that that is the natural operating position shown in all the figures, but most especially figure 7 of the 669. And we would refer the court to compare, we were talking about the red brief at 7 with that citation to the intrinsic evidence from the file history. That's at appendix 6563. Those figures, when you compare those figures to the 669 figure 9A, at appendix 387, they're exactly the same. And they're exactly the same figures that Dr. Rausch used to prove or to show the infringement. So we think that that shows that, and I also point out that the jury found enablement of the patent, that you can practice the patent. And so the other thing I want to point out is that counsel said something about that there has to be an exact point on the straddle type seat. Again, let's look at the claim construction. A portion of the straddle type seat, understanding that when someone sits down, they're not going to contact the seat only at one point. The issue here about indefiniteness is reasonable certainty. Let me be brief on anticipation. We don't agree that that was a public disclosure when Mr. Hattin took Arctic Cat's vice president out for a ride. We don't even think it was corroborated. In fact, if you were going to accept Arctic Cat's evidence presented to the jury in this case as sufficient corroboration, a single interested witness, you would be undoing Finnegan to start with. You would also be undoing basically a century of corroboration requirements by the Supreme Court and this court, because to Judge Lurie, to your point, credibility is not the issue. It's we don't defer and say, well, one person's telling one story, as long as they're credible, we'll let it get by. That is not the corroboration requirement. They have the duty by clear and convincing evidence to show that this Hattin was ever public. And I would ask the court to compare the facts of this case to the Moleculon Research case, the Rubik's Cube case, where there was a lot more disclosure by that inventor than there was by Mr. Hattin. Briefly on obviousness, as Judge Stoll, you pointed out, the jury didn't buy their story on obviousness as to those claims 92 through 95. So there was substantial evidence, and the district court cited to it in its JMOL. But the other point we would make is we believe that the anticipation result that the court reached was wrong below. Hattin and Foxtrack don't anticipate, neither one anticipates, And so without anticipating references, they can never get to obviousness anyway, because they're missing necessary elements of the patented invention.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has been consumed.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement.